glad you're here. We're glad you're here. Fellowship, sweeter, knowing you're near. It's so good to see you. I hope that it's fair. Everyone loves you.
Oh, magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. It's Wednesday, November 18th, 2015. And in his car, what are you driving today, Bob?
I'm driving a 2004 Ford Ranger.
Okay, you're parked somewhere, I think, outside of your work area or something?
Yes, that's correct.
And we have you on the line because Jason contacted me yesterday and said, you know, Mark, in light of what's going on in the world, with Bob being an expert and having a lot of background with the understanding of the Muslim world, let's call him up and hash out some of the thoughts on how can we maybe pray more specifically, what could we be aware of or mindful of. And I know, Jason, you had a couple thoughts on why Bob and why have him on today.
Well, yeah, Bob is a wonderful friend of the station, and again, as you already said, he has spent more time and walked through the pages of the Quran, walked through this Islamic ideology and understanding it, having conversations such that have helped him to understand the mind of a Muslim and the theology behind Islam, which I think many of us don't get, and the major media doesn't really give us that picture. And so in light of the things that happened in Paris just this last week, Bob, could you maybe spend a few moments for the listener and give us a proper frame to look at this group ISIS through, or look through this Islamic ideology that causes this incident in Paris, and I think a lot of other incidents if we were to connect the dots.
Yeah, I sure can. I want to start by saying there's a lot of confusion, both in the media especially, but I mean just in terms of when you talk to people about what exactly is going on. And you hear things like, okay, well, not all Muslims are terrorists. Okay, well, that's true. I mean, certainly that's true. So what's happening here? I mean, for example, if you go to the Central Illinois Mosque here in Champaign, you know, you will not hear anything along those lines. And so that's great that the mosque here is fairly bland as far as matters of jihad go. But the situation is a little more complicated. And to get a handle on this, the way to think about this is, or at least this is how, as I've gone through the Islamic literature and have seen it, it was described really well by a man named David Wood from Acts 17 Ministries. And he describes it this way: to have a terrorist, you need three things. You need all three, and if you're missing any of these three, you will not have a terrorist. Here are the three items. Number one, belief in Islam. Now, belief in Islam by itself doesn't necessarily create a terrorist. There are a lot of Muslims who are not terrorists. The second item is knowledge of Islam. There are many Muslims who don't know what the Quran says about jihad, what the hadiths say about jihad, what Muhammad himself said about jihad. And so they just don't know. And so there are Muslims who are just average workaday Muslims who are fine people because they don't know what their religion prescribes for them. And the third item is obedience. Obedience to what Islam teaches. There are many Muslims who know what Islam teaches, but either due to their conscience or just due to choosing the path of least resistance, they don't want to go down that road of obedience to what they are told to do. However, when you combine all these three things, someone who believes in Islam, who has knowledge of Islam, and chooses to be obedient to that knowledge and what is prescribed for them, that's when you get what our media would term a radicalized Muslim.
So in that framework, let me ask you this question, because I read something that was fascinating, and it was the statement that was released by ISIS post the Paris attacks. First of all, to preface this, there was a Pew study that was done in 2014 that said in France, so in France, about 40% of France is historic Catholic, kind of religion in name only, 5% Protestant, 20% agnostic, 15% atheist, 8% Islamic, very low. And then there were kind of 12% of the French population that just would say themselves as nuns or others.
Not nuns as in N-U-N.
Right, yeah. Nuns as in N-O-N-E-S. So France in itself sees itself as kind of irreligious, largely irreligious. And yet the statement that ISIS released, they called France a crusader nation. So they lumped France in with kind of this historic Christianity that moved the Crusades out. Now, why, Bob, would we have these two different views?
Well, I don't know how much I can speak to why, but I can testify to the truth of that disparity. For example, the Muslims that I talk to, when I share with them how my heart aches that we are no longer a Christian nation, they have the strangest looks on their faces. They can't understand what I'm saying. And when they ask me about it and I try to explain that, they're just befuddled. I mean, how can you say this is not a Christian nation? And now, as a Christian, we look around and we see what's happening to our country, some of the pushes for secularism, the decline of various institutions. We see that as very obvious. But from a Muslim's point of view, politics and religion are so intertwined that they sort of view everyone as having a religion. For someone to say none, there's not really a container for that to them. I mean, they can understand what an atheist is. I mean, or, you know, a pagan, as the Quran would say. But there's just not a place for them to classify someone as, you know, Christian in name only.
Mm. And so out of this statement that they made where they said, look, you're a crusader nation, they again emphasized, and I think you need to rightly for us identify or define these terms, that they have a caliph and that they have formed a caliphate. And so what are those two terms and why is that so important to this ideological movement, radical Islam?
Well, that's a very good question. And to answer that, we need to understand historically, Muslims have had a caliphate, which is, you can think of it like a Muslim pope, as a head of the entire religion. You know, when the caliphate speaks, you know, word comes down from on high. This is the interpretation of these rules as Muslims deal with new situations, and they need to make various laws and determinations upon how the religion should handle these new events or situations or technologies. It was the caliphate or the caliph who would ultimately have say. And similarly, the caliph would have say over how Muslims should be acting and interacting with non-believers. So having said all that, in 1924, the caliphate was dismantled by Kemal Atatürk, who was then prime minister of Turkey. And so Muslims have gone for about 100 years without this head, without this person who is responsible for guiding the Islamic community.
And what was the reason for that? Was there dissension or different sects, or did the Sunnis or, you know, the Shiites or somebody say, hey, we don't buy into that guy overseeing our sect?
Well, Turkey was moving more toward wanting to become a little bit of a more westernized nation at that time, and that was seen as a way to do it. This was after they had suffered, they were on the wrong side of World War One, and some things had happened, and they wanted to move more toward a westernized way and be more accepted, and so, you know, they had dismantled the caliphate. Hmm. What's interesting about this is that for the last 100 years, there have been many Muslims who have longed for the return of that caliphate. What we don't tend to think about is that now that the caliphate has been reinstated, we tend to think of it as, okay, this is just like it was historically back, you know, in the 7th, 8th, 9th century, whenever. But this is the 21st century. What has happened in the past 100 years is that global communication has become instantaneous. Social media and other things of that nature have meant that what a caliphate means to the Islamic community now is worlds apart from what it meant 100 years ago. It's completely different. And I don't think anyone really knows yet just how far that goes.
And so why, when this caliphate, and maybe you can give us a date when this new caliphate was introduced, who is the caliph and why is he so important to this? Why is this particular person at this particular time, why has he been able to rise up and be so instrumental and powerful within this movement?
Well, I believe it was June of last year, although I might have the month wrong on that. It might have been July, but I know it was around summertime of 2014. And his name is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And the reason why he's been able to gain such momentum is because there have been a lot of Muslims who have wanted the caliphate to return. And so a lot of Muslims have given him their allegiance. In fact, that's one of the things that if you know a lot about Islam and you want to be obedient to Islam, that's one of the things that you're supposed to do, is you're supposed to give allegiance to an imam or to a scholar or to someone sort of above you as a mentor, so to speak. And so when the caliph was reinstated, a lot of Muslims gave their allegiance to that caliph. So if that caliph says, all right, everybody, we're going to go this way, we're going to do this thing, then there's, by definition, a large group of Muslims who will follow that.
Now, has he been making some pronouncements? Is he a catalyst behind ISIS?
And what's interesting is I've done a little reading. In fact, I wrote an article that I published in our church newsletter regarding some of this. But he's rather learned man, isn't he?
I believe so. And I don't remember a lot of the details, but I do remember that he was someone who was a scholar.
Yeah, and as I've read some of the things, they've said between, you know, U.S. intelligence and, again, as you're saying, this instantaneous communication message boards that jihadists kind of embody or whatever on the internet, that they can't tell where the inflation of the myth has begun and where it ends, but somehow they figured out that he has a PhD in Islamic studies from the University of Baghdad, and that he is a learned man, not only in, I think speaking already to your point, Bob, in the scriptures and what they would say, but also in how technology works and able to move those processes along, because the key to the movement is getting the successes out, I believe, isn't it?
Well, right. And I think that, again, we don't really understand how the combination of what I would call true Islamic theology, and by that I mean what is Islamic theology at its core, not that it is correct, but that if you, not the mediaized version of what they think Islamic theology is. What is the intersection of what Islam teaches and this revolution in communication? And the caliphate has knowledge of both. And so I don't think we're really certain yet all of the repercussions of how this is going to play out.
One thing that I've only heard a little bit, I listened to a couple of people talking about it. This was non-media. It was more experts from the Jenkins Center for the Christian Study of Islam down at Southern Seminary. There have been some little snippets that have come out. But can you walk us through because I think it's important for people to understand, what does this particular sect, ISIS, of radical Islam, think about the end times? And what is, because of that, how do they see their eschatology, and what then is their goal?
Well, throughout the hadith, which is the stories of Muhammad's life, things that he said, there are a variety of passages where Muhammad says that jihad is incumbent upon the Muslims until there is no longer any unbelievers. And so from an eschatological point of view, if they want to sort of usher in the next age, they believe that they can do so by escalating the violence. That's what that is in a nutshell. And we could go into a lot more detail about how they would see that play out. But, you know, one of the hadiths, for example, talks about that the last day will not come until the Muslims go to fight and eradicate all the Jews. And the Jews will, even the ones that will hide behind a stone, the stones themselves will cry out, "Oh, Muslim, there is a Jew behind me, come kill him."
Mm. And so is the end goal to win, or is the end goal to lose? Because I've heard both answers. I've heard that radicalized Islam wants to win, but in order to do that, they actually have to lose. And in their losing, it will be God who comes to save them. And so one of the things that I had heard, and I would like you to correct if it's not right, is that if we fight them, we reach their goal. And if we don't fight them, they continue with what they're doing to reach their goal.
Well, yes, I would agree with that. And so I have not heard that they are in this to lose so that Allah will come rescue them. I believe that they feel they can win. However, I would say that they feel they can win the long game. They're not looking at this as we can win next month or next year or even this decade. But they're looking at it in terms of that they will win the long game. Islam is a religion which does appeal to the flesh. It's taking over in large measure in a lot of places that it has not been historically. And so they look at it as, you know, even if they lose this battle or even this war, the next generation will come along and do their part. And eventually, due to a variety of techniques, they will be able to win and bring about the end times. Mm. But I want to get to your point, because you said something along the lines of, you know, if we fight them, that's a sort of further circle because it instigates and catalyzes more of a fight. And if we don't do anything, well, they just keep doing what they're doing. And I think there's a lot of truth in that, and that is that there's not really a political answer to this. I think what's happening is a lot of people are running around looking for this political answer, and the answer is spiritual. I mean, the answer is the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not one that politicians are ready to discuss.
Yeah. And it's fueled by fear, because I did some Google searching, and I know Google searching is not always going to elicit the best or most factual answer. So I tried my best to check. But I mean, in the last month or so, ISIS has attacked Russia, Lebanon, Great Britain, Egypt, Baghdad, Beirut. You know, they brought down that plane with 224 people on it. And this is the same Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi who, and I don't know again where myth begins and where myth ends, but who told that colonel when he was leaving the Camp Buka, you know, I'll see you guys later in New York. And I think that elicits in people fear, especially when we're talking about this growing refugee crisis and, you know, the need for nations to absorb some of these refugees, which, you know, rightly, I see that. I don't know how as Christians we don't in some way level do that, because we have those horrible images of that little boy who washed up on the shores of Syria there and who had died trying to escape that oppression. But maybe in the last, you know, we have about 4 or 5 minutes, Bob, can you walk us through maybe what is our response to that? Because I think that now that's with the governors kind of coming and saying, no refugees, no this. Are we playing again into the hand of these radicalized Islamic terrorists, or are we doing the right thing?
Well, again, this is a political question, and Jason, you know me, I don't typically like to go down this road, because there are good-meaning people on both sides of the issue, and it's a complicated one, because one of the attackers in Paris did come over as a Syrian refugee, and yet the gospel clearly tells us that we are to provide for the aliens and strangers in our land and to look out for our fellow humans and do what we can, especially when we have the good news that we can bring them. So, you know, where do you go with this? And that's a very hard question. I know that God wants something bigger for us rather than to squabble about the political avenues in terms of how we should face this crisis. The gospel of Jesus Christ is powerful. It's the answer. And how we employ that as the church at large, and that's a good question. That's a bigger question than I could ever answer.
And I think, Jason, on your church newsletter that recently came out, I think just yesterday or the day before, you kind of answered it by focusing on the power of prayer.
Yeah, I basically said that, look, we have to, rubber meets the road as Christians when you ask me to pray for my enemies, because I don't like my enemies. And I don't like certain politicians, and I don't like terrorists. You know, I mean, if we're really honest, and I think that, Bob, if people are frustrated today listening, it's because you're touching a nerve, and that nerve is that I don't want to get on my knees and lift up Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. I mean,
right.
I don't want to.
And Matthew 5:44 clearly tells us that's what we are to do.
Right. And it says, I mean, there's evidence in Acts that as Paul was breathing out murder against the church was praying. And we need to be about that. We need to be about this intersection where our faith takes us into a place that's uncomfortable. It takes us into a place where we are unsure of how it's going to work out, where we actually have to rely on faith. I think as Western Christians, sometimes we say we're relying on faith, but what we're really relying on is kind of our own comfort, our own knowledge, our own strength, our own abilities, instead of clearly out in that gray area where faith has to reign supreme. I don't know the heart of this man, this al-Baghdadi, but I know the heart of God. And I know what the heart of God can do when it meets even the most evil and vile man, you know, because I know what he did in the heart of Paul of Tarsus.
Right, and God can reach into anywhere with dreams and visions and other kinds of things like that that happen within the Muslim world. And I mean, if the church prayed that there would be a revival somehow in Syria, God can do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really funny because I was doing some Googling, and Jim Cimbala has that church, the Brooklyn Tabernacle. And so he's in Brooklyn, but I think, you know, you still would consider that New York. And somebody brought up this topic with him, and they made mention of this Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi said, "I'll see you in New York." And Jim Cimbala said, "I hope so. I'll have the doors open." You know, of the church. And because he said, "I want to welcome him in, and however this works out, I'm going to share the gospel." I mean, because if you come in the doors of the church, you're going to worship and you're going to hear the gospel. And I think that that's kind of the right answer.
Yeah, it has to be the answer. It has to be. And, you mentioned Paul of Tarsus a number of times. I mean, it always kind of strikes me as funny when Ananias, I think it was Ananias, was the guy, "Wait, don't you know who that is?"
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
"But God, don't you know these people are trying to kill us?" Yeah, okay. God knows.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it seems like, yeah, prayer will be the thing that all of us can certainly do, and God responds to prayer, and just seems like that's what he's called us all to do, even this very day.
Well, Bob, we appreciate you carving out a little bit of time to help bring some clarity to this. Again, I think that the media voice is so loud and so prominent, it's instantaneous, but it doesn't always mean that it's the correct information or even that it's informational in terms of how we need to react to these things. And I just want to thank you, Bob, for being a great voice to help us to understand Islam to the radio station. But also, I think that just in this last closing moments, if anybody out there in the larger kind of church context needs somebody to come and share to talk about what Islam is, what Islam isn't, what does it mean, what does the Quran really say, what is the Islamic end times really about. Bob, how could somebody get a hold of you so that they could have you come and share and really bring some clarity to what is continuing to become murkier and murkier and murkier water?
There are a number of ways to contact me. Probably the best way is to go to my website, which is unravelingislam.com. I have a number of articles there so people can see kind of who I am and what I'm about. And there's a form there you can fill out, and that'll just go right to me. And then once I see who you are, I'll give you a call. And we'll set up a time to meet and talk about what I can do to help you out at your church or whatever you'd like to do.
UnravelingIslam.com. UnravelingIslam.com, right?
That's correct.
All right. Well, thanks, Bob, and thank you, Pastor Jason, for being available for today, the Wednesday edition of Mark and Friends. And thanks for listening in. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for wrestling with this topic with us. And please be in prayer as God can move the hand of all leaders throughout the world and desires to move our even hearts this very day. He loves you, and he has a plan and purpose for your life. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a part of this radio listening family. This is Mark Burns and Pastor Jason Schiffel with the Ministry of Great News Radio. God bless you, and have a great day and night.